Case number 24-3151, United States of America v. Gary D. Richardson, appellant. Ms. Millian for the appellant, Mr. Glasser for the appellee.
Good morning, Ms. Millian, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Courtney Millian on behalf of Mr. Richardson, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. 18 U.S.C. 922G1 disarms Mr. Richardson based on his two prior carrying a pistol without a license convictions. Carrying a pistol without a license is not a crime, much less a felony, in most states in the union. Notwithstanding this fact, the government claims he can be disarmed consistent with the Second Amendment under 922G1. It is wrong. I'd like to focus my argument on Mr. Richardson's as-applied challenge, though, of course, I welcome the court's questions on the facial challenge to the extent it has them. Bruin and Rahimi make clear that the burden rests with the government to demonstrate a sufficiently robust enough historical tradition to justify its modern firearm regulation. To do so, it must point to a historical tradition that shares both a comparable burden and that is comparably justified. The government has failed to meet that burden here.
Why doesn't Medina take care of this aspect of the analysis?
So Medina has been overruled by Bruin and Rahimi and is distinguishable. I'm happy to discuss either of those.
It seemed to hold that 922G1 is consistent with the history and tradition of firearms regulation in this country.
So I don't think it did so, or certainly did not do so using the test set out in Bruin and Rahimi, and thus has been overruled. The challenge brought by the plaintiff in that case was this argument that only dangerous felons could be disarmed under 922G1. It was an as-applied challenge, and the court erred in several ways and in ways that are fundamentally inconsistent with the reasoning of Bruin and Rahimi, and thus mean the decision's been overruled. First and foremost, it erred in placing the burden on the plaintiff to demonstrate.
Well, I'd like to understand better why you think that it's inconsistent with Bruin and Rahimi, because it did not use a means-ends balancing test, which seems to be the main thing that was definitely overruled by Bruin and Rahimi. And the type of analysis it did seems quite consistent with what Bruin is asking for.
So part of what Bruin did certainly was overrule means ends balancing, but that's not all it did. It made clear that the burden rests with the government to demonstrate that historical burden, and that's repeated again quite clearly in Rahimi. And in that particular respect, the court fundamentally erred in Medina by placing the burden on the plaintiff.
Place the burden on the plaintiff?
It talks about how the plaintiff's sources do not compel the conclusion that only dangerous persons can be disarmed, but it was not the plaintiff's burden to cite sources that compel the conclusion. It was the government's burden. So in that respect, and that's fundamentally core to the court's reasoning, it gets that wrong. It also mentions sort of the absence of primary sources on point. Again, that is used as evidence in Bruin and Rahimi. Particularly Bruin, for the idea that this is not the kind of thing that can justify disarmament. The court gets that wrong. It relies on the virtuous citizen principle, which was clearly overruled in Rahimi. I mean, it actually even overruled a watered-down version called the responsible citizen test that the government had attempted to invoke. It also relies on this concept that dangerousness is too amorphous, which again is wrong.
There are aspects of Medina that it turns out are problematic, to be sure. The placement of the burden, the reference to virtuous citizens. But when you look at the decision writ large, it's doing history and tradition. And after the statement about the burden of proof, it addresses history and tradition and goes through all the tradition of, the tradition is felons can have all their stuff taken away and be executed.
So it certainly relies on this death concept, which is probably the only piece of it that I think wasn't overruled or clearly overruled. The problem is that's just a single piece of the court's overall reasoning and not the only thing it's hanging its hat on. And when we have, I've cited precedent.
Pretty important.
It is important.
I mean, the virtuous citizen thing is an afterthought.
I don't read it as an afterthought. But I would also just note, if I also think Medina is distinguishable because it did not consider whether felons whose priors, you know, modern day felons whose priors have no founding analog would not have been punished at, with death at the founding. It does not answer the question because the parties never asked it to. There's not part of what was briefed. It never answered the question of whether death can justify their disarmament. And it can't hear that death-based set of reasoning actually supports Mr. Richardson's as-applied challenge because his prior offense, carrying a pistol without a license, has no founding era analog, would not even have been a crime at the founding, much less one punished by death.
If you look at as applied, if you look at the circumstances of Mr. Medina versus Mr. Richardson, I'm not sure that's a very favorable comparison for you.
So, I mean, I think it is an analysis that's properly confined to Mr. Richardson. I mean,
if the question is, you know, is the felony kind of more malum in prohibitum regulatory, is the offense, is the person not dangerous or violent? I mean, Medina was less obviously violent than Richardson, at least according to the indictment.
So there's a lot in that, and I want to unpack it in a couple of stages. First of all, I think Medina's prior felony, which was lying on a mortgage application, he was accused of fraud. People were put to death for fraud at the founding. People were not put to death for carrying a pistol without a license or for anything analogous. And the government hasn't claimed that they were. On the
versus,
the as-applied,
versus the conduct that was charged here.
So if you look
but
at
it, it's not the world's most serious offense, but the charge, the conduct is very serious.
So the conduct surrounding
out in a garage in a nightclub, guy gets shot. He's involved in that.
So a couple of things there. The as applied analysis, I mean, the conduct in the parking garage, which I repeat are allegations, Mr. Richardson never admitted to them. That conduct is not properly part of an as-applied analysis because an as-applied analysis, what disarms Mr. Richardson and why 922G1 applies to him is because of his prior carrying a pistol without a license convictions. It is not because of that conduct, which to be clear, if the government had thought indeed happened and it could have proved, it was more than welcome to charge. That other information, I mean, he's not disarmed because of any alleged like attempted threats, assault or anything. That's simply not what 922G1 is doing. And that's a choice Congress made. And that's a choice about how Congress wrote that statute.
What about the fact that he's on supervised release?
So
he's still serving a sentence for one of those, right?
So again, I just don't think that's relevant to an as-applied analysis under 922G1. 922G1 references a term of imprisonment. It's not talking about supervised release. Now, supervised release would be relevant.
It's applied to your client. And if he's somebody who's on supervised release, it seems that he's the kind of person that could be disarmed. Other circuits have held so.
So I think we would be in a different world if this was a, you know, supervised revocation proceeding and we were challenging, you know, Mr. Richardson's revocation under supervised release. That's
that
not where we are.
Other cases, because I guess there are at least three other circuits that have held that it's constitutionally applied to people who are on supervised release.
So that's right. And I think those circuits get it wrong. And I would just note, first of all, that the Third Circuit, which is one of the courts that has been doing this, has actually recently taken a couple of cases on bonk and specifically asked them to brief this question of what facts can be considered in as applied analysis under 922G1. So I think there may well be the
well,
you know,
have
time
any
will tell.
To support your position that this is not properly taken into account?
They don't, but I think it follows from.
I'm asking you, do you have any precedent to support your position that you're taking before us that we can't consider the fact that he's on supervised release?
So I think it follows from, I mean, I don't have a case right now, but I think it follows from the Supreme Court's decision in Brahimi and the way it has understood as applied analyses in other contexts. If you look at the court's decision in Brahimi, I mean, it chronicles a whole bunch of very serious conduct by Mr. Rahimi in the background section of its brief. But when it came time to do the as-applied analysis, and to be clear, it repeatedly calls it as applied to Mr. Rahimi, it confined itself to what was relevant to the statute's application under 922G8, and in particular, you know, the finding that would have been made by a judge. And I think that exactly models the proper analysis here. We're not looking at extraneous facts that have nothing to do with why Mr. Richardson was disarmed under 922G1. And, you know, similarly, we cite a number of, and the amicus brief in support of our case cites a number of other Supreme Court decisions, like Eichmann, for example, where the Supreme Court recognized that someone who had burned a flag and caused damage to government property could be prosecuted under a property damage statute that made that property damage relevant,
Your
but could not be.
Then is what we can consider as applied to him, specific to him, is the fact that his prior convictions were CPWL?
Yes.
But we can't consider the fact that he's still serving the sentence of one of those CPWL convictions.
Correct, because that's not what 922G1 disarms him based on. And I would
it
also just
like that's a fact that's intertwined with us considering that he's been convicted of CPWL.
Respectfully, I don't think so, because that's not what's triggered his disarmament under 922G1. It's the fact of the conviction, not the sentence. And I would separately note, it's not clear to me, quite frankly, what was going on with the supervised release. As we know, I mean, there is indication in the record he likely was on supervised release, but there's also this statement in the PSR that Mr. Richardson successfully completed his supervised release. And I think that at least raises the question on this record about, you know, whether he was on supervised release or at least, you know, whether the terms of his supervised release prevented him from having this firearm.
Sorry, why can't we even consider the fact that he's on supervised release?
Because that's not
applied challenge.
Because that's not why he's been disarmed under 922G1. It's just not what has caused him to be disarmed. Whether or not he was on supervised release is irrelevant.
But the as applied rule that you're advocating is some form of you know, you look at the facts and circumstances and assess the individual, right? You look to dangerousness, you look to criminal conduct. Why would we not consider that?
So the type of test I'm advocating for is one that can find, you know, that follows the model that the Supreme Court set out in Rahimi and confines itself to what is relevant to 922G1's application, just like the Supreme Court confined itself to what was relevant to 922G8's application.
Although there was a court order.
What?
There was a court order in Rahimi, correct?
Yes.
And here there's a court-ordered supervised release.
Sure, but that 922G8 disarmed him based on Mr. Rahimi, based on the existence of the court order. That was like part of what the statute was doing.
And
that is not.
And the supervised release, did it not provide that he was to remain unarmed for the period of his supervision?
It's not clear to me on this record.
Suppose
that it did.
Suppose it did, then what?
I still think we prevail because, I mean, that would be entirely relevant to a revocation of supervised release. And,
right,
you know, if we were in that posture,
but
I would.
But we're here now, not in supervised release, but not in a revocation proceeding. So he's under a court, assume he's under a court order that prohibits him from having a gun while he's under supervised release. How is that any different than Rahimi for
Barbara? For the reasons I said, which is that 922G8 made that court order relevant. And Rahimi, that's, you know, the statute that Congress wrote. That's simply not what Congress did in 922G1. It's not a supervised release disarmament
Suppose
statute.
Suppose he was still in prison then.
I mean, he'd be guilty of violating a law that had to do with.
He's in prison. He manages to obtain a weapon, which happens from time to time.
I would think, first of all, that's a different circumstance because at least there, 922G1 is talking about imprisonment. But I still think then, you know, he needs to be prosecuted.
It doesn't say imprisonment. It doesn't any more than it says under a court order.
But
it just says felony conviction.
I'm not sure that's quite right, but setting that aside, I mean, I think the way to make that legally relevant is to prosecute, whoever it is under a statute prohibiting someone from having firearms in prison. No one's saying these can't, that's not a crime. It just needs to, if the government wants to stand up and argue that someone can be disarmed based on these facts that are totally extraneous to the charge that it has brought and the injury that it has caused, it needs to actually charge that conduct. And there are plenty of laws that it could have used here and could have made these types of things relevant. But there's a reason it didn't do so. In my estimation, it's because it didn't think it could prove that.
So it seems to me that I thought that an as-applied challenge just required us to look at whether the law is constitutional as applied to this individual. So we would be then allowed to look at the facts and circumstances of this individual. And since this individual is on supervised release, then it's constitutional to disarm him because people who are still serving their sentences shouldn't have firearms. And then that's consistent with what three other circuits have held. And it seemed consistent with lots of things like public safety concerns, et cetera. You're saying even if it's true that he shouldn't have a firearm, based on his individual circumstances of being on supervised release, even if that's true, I can't consider it and I shouldn't consider it. And to me, that seems very technical. And I think what you're asking for is for us to consider the same individual in several different, I guess, there would have to be several different cases against him. Like, we'd have to wait until they move to revoke his supervised release or something in order to consider the fact that he was on supervised release. Like, how would we be able to consider this relevant fact?
I think exactly what you said, which is that they would move to, I mean, they could have charged Mr. Richardson with the assault if they thought they could prove he committed assault. They could have charged Mr. Richardson with the Glock switch if they thought that they could prove that he knowingly had.
So even if the facts are in the record and there, and even if he, like, assume for the sake of argument that you concede that the fact that he's on supervised release would be an appropriate and constitutional basis to disarm him, we cannot consider that basis unless it's charged. Is that it?
That's right. I mean, how I think of an as-applied challenge based on things like City of Los Angeles versus Patel, which talks about what it means. That was a facial case, but it talks about what it means for a statute to apply and for its application to be relevant.
Then you're defining constitutional rights based on charging decisions or a mistake by the government in missing a charging decision. And I don't. Do you have any precedent for that kind of highly technical and granular analysis to assess a constitutional right based on, I guess, charging decisions like that, even if the facts are there?
I mean, I've referenced it already, which is the Supreme Court's decision in
Rahimi. But just because they did it that way doesn't mean it's required. If they do it that way in one case, doesn't mean that's a requirement.
I think it modeled the appropriate analysis. And I think particularly when you look at some of the other cases we've cited outside of the Second Amendment context, like Eichmann, like Grace, like Illinois, Williams versus Illinois, it illustrates that the government can't justify the constitutionality of a law based on facts that are irrelevant. I mean, it's an as-applied test. And so the question
is relevant. You're conceding it's relevant. You're just saying that even if it is relevant, we can't consider it if it's not charged.
Well, I'm conceding it's relevant if you'd attempted to revoke someone. I'm not at all conceding it's relevant to 922G1. I mean, it's decidedly not. And under Your Honor's reasoning, Mr. Richardson would
I guess
have been,
it's relevant to whether he could be constitutionally disarmed, but you're just saying we can't consider it based on the way this case was litigated.
We can't consider it because, I mean, to be clear, 922G1 would always be unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Richardson. What might not be unconstitutional is a revocation of supervised release, because that has to do with how supervised release is applied.
Oh, sorry, you're losing me.
Makes sense.
you're losing me here. Take the facts of this case, and the government moves to revoke supervised release based on Richardson having the firearm, and that succeeds, and he goes back to prison.
Yes.
Then what?
Then if we had brought a Second Amendment challenge, and all the facts were established. And I just note the government did not make these arguments in its briefing below about its as-applied challenge. So we've obviously argued waiver. And I just, I want to engage with Your Honor's questions, but I just want to put that on the record. I think probably that would be fine. If the government had invoked authority, like from Congress, from statutes that allow supervised release revocation and make that relevant to the application, then I think that would be fine.
It? What if they had moved to revoke his supervised release, but it just isn't in the briefing or wasn't considered? Because there is a chance that have they done that? I mean, I would be surprised if they hadn't moved to revoke his supervised release.
I don't think they have. I mean, the PSSR says his probation was completed successfully. But it's not relevant to 922G1.
Wait, I'm sorry. It was completed successfully despite the fact that he got this conviction while he was on.
That's what the PSR says. Which is why it's not clear to me he was on supervision. I mean, that's a bizarre statement in the PSR. And I just don't know what to make of this record, given that it says his probation was completed successfully.
Well, probation is different from supervised release. Could it be he had two prior CPWLs because could he have completed one of them and not supervised release on the other?
I don't think so. I've seen no indication of that.
I don't think they would call supervised release probation in a PSR. It would be a totally different thing, right?
Well, we've been talking about supervised release, but I think the government's, these are both like state DC charges. I believe we're only ever talking about probation and we've just maybe
there
been
a
little
10 day gap, right? Between the indictment and the end of his period of supervised release. Isn't that right?
According to the PSR, it ended 10 days later. I mean,
Right. So, I mean, the most likely scenario is that the probation office didn't know, right, that he'd been indicted again.
I have no... We don't know, which is why I think resting a fact...
But if we do find...
This court's decision...
If we do find that there's a prohibition on arms in the PSR, that's more relevant.
I just think.
I take your argument. I know what you're.
Yeah, given the confusion here on this record, it would be inappropriate to rest on the supervision. Right. But I just want to get back to this idea because clearly I've confused everybody, and I really don't mean to be confusing. 922G1 disarms someone based on their prior conviction. It has nothing to do with supervised release. So while someone might be able to be like constitutionally incarcerated.
But 922G disarms somebody based on their prior conviction, merely based on the fact that the length of incarceration is a year or more.
Yeah.
It doesn't on its face allow us to get into what was the conviction. But you're saying we can do that. And if we can do that, why can't we look at whether he's on supervised release? Because we're looking beyond just what 922G says.
So I think the way to think about it is that Mr. Richardson is disarmed based on this CPWL conviction and that.
But 922G doesn't distinguish between CPWL or mortgage fraud or anything. It just says prior felony. And you're asking us to look beyond that. And why is it that we can look beyond that to see what the felony was, but we can't look beyond it to see the circumstances of this defendant? Like
I guess because of the longstanding idea that the government can't justify the constitutionality of its regulation by arguing that it could have properly written a statute that would have been constitutional had it written it some
other way. I don't
understand
that. I don't understand what you just said.
Okay.
That sounds like an argument lawyers sometimes make in a facial context to, claim the right to a facially constitutional rule. Doesn't sound like how as applied challenges normally work. As applied challenge, I mean, you got, lots of lots of cases, you know, you have a statute that prohibits a bunch of different things, and someone wants to bring an as-applied First Amendment challenge because the charged conduct in the case involved speech, and you look at the facts of the case.
So respectfully, I don't agree that that's, I think there's ample precedent for the idea that that, particularly when you look at Rahimi, is not the way to go about doing this challenge here.
Conceptually, you're resting on cases like Eichmann. And
yes.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, thanks. We'll give you some rebuttal.
Yep.
Mr. Glasser.
Thank you. May it please the court, William Glasser for the United States. The Second Amendment does not protect Mr. Richardson's possession of a firearm. In this case, his as-applied challenge cannot fail, and cannot prevail. And his facial challenge that I don't think has been really at issue here certainly fails under the standard that the Supreme Court articulated in Rahimi and this court's decision in Medina. I'd like to start with Medina because I think that's the most straightforward way for this court to resolve the case. This court applies a fairly strict standard for determining that the Supreme Court has overruled prior precedent. This court said that the Supreme Court decision must clearly dictate a departure from circuit precedent or effectively overrule or eviscerate circuit precedent. Now, it's true, as Judge Katz, as you pointed out, that there are some differences in the analysis under Medina in a sort of a post-Bruin world, but Bruin reaffirmed what Medina did, which is to apply a historically based analysis. Medina said, quote, to resolve this question, that is the constitutionality of G1, we must look to tradition and history. And that's exactly what Bruin said courts must do. So although there might be, you know, areas on the margins where this court would not write Medina in exactly the same way today, Medina is still binding on this court because the Supreme Court hasn't eviscerated that decision.
I agree with you on the virtuous citizen part of Medina. But I read all of the history and tradition in Medina flowing from or analyzed under the premise that it was Medina's burden of proof to establish relevant tradition. And that would seem to infect or at least make incomplete the court's analysis of the history and tradition.
Your Honor, I don't think Medina was clear on which party bore the burden. So Medina started out by talking about the historical tradition of executing felons or at least authorizing the death penalty for felons and only mentioned something that could be construed as burden language in the second paragraph when considering the sort of second point when considering whether only dangerous persons could be disarmed. And there Medina said none of the sources cited by Medina compels this conclusion. I mean, I think that this court could easily, while leaving the burden on the government, say that the party without the burden hasn't shown anything to sort of rebut the government's showing. So I'm not entirely clear that Medina was speaking in burden language. But I think if you reread Medina with placing the burden on the government, Medina could still come to the same conclusion. So I don't think you should sort of overread that one sentence in Medina as improperly placing the burden on the civil plaintiff there.
Or maybe that was harmless error.
Sure. I don't think it affects the bottom line of the decision, Your Honor. And you know, as we've demonstrated in our brief, there are sort of two historical traditions that we think support Section 922 G1, even in a post-Bruin world. Medina primarily relied on the first of those traditions, not the disarming of the dangerous, but rather the fact that—
treatment of felons.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right.
We think that the dangerousness rationale is just further support that would support this court's decision in Medina. The Ninth Circuit, for example, in the en banc Duarte case, relied on both of those traditions to uphold Section 922 G1. And I would point out that six other circuits have actually just relied on the Supreme Court's statements in cases like Heller that Section 922 G1 and similar statutes are presumptively lawful to conclude that Bruin didn't overrule prior circuit precedent. Those courts didn't have anything nearly as strong as Medina, which applied that historical tradition test. But I think even those courts' analysis is persuasive and relevant because those courts concluded that the Supreme Court statements about felon dispossession statutes were enough to indicate that Bruin was not clearly overruling circuit precedent.
You may or may not be right about Medina. Strikes me as a little messy, but the government, is there some reason why we shouldn't just have a narrow, bright line rule that the statute is constitutional as applied to individuals on supervised release?
Your Honor, we wouldn't have any quarrel.
Seemed to me, the easiest unanimous circuits.
Sure.
Got a pretty aggressive opinion by Judge Hardiman, who has been very protective of the Second Amendment, and he thought this was an easy case in your favor.
So, Your Honor, we certainly wouldn't have any quarrel with a narrow ruling like that. I would note, though, that as my colleague here pointed out, the Third Circuit has sua sponte granted rehearing en banc in two cases that sort of follow on from Judge Hartman's decision and more. So those cases are BOST, which is a criminal case, and
how do you spell it?
B-O-S-T. I apologize, I don't have the case number in front of me, but BOST and then Williams versus the Attorney General, which is a civil case. In both of those cases, the Third Circuit granted rehearing sua sponte and asked for briefing on this question of whether you can consider conduct that that's not charged or occurs after the underlying conviction. So although we would be perfectly happy with that rule in this case, I worry that the question would be up in front of this court again in the next 922 G1 case where someone was not on supervision. And
that's not our problem.
fair enough, Judge Ginsburg. But also that is at least a matter of dispute within the Third Circuit. So
just seems like that is a not insignificant ruling for the government. And we have another Second Amendment case pending in the Supreme Court, which between now and June, we might get more guidance on dangerousness.
Sure.
Writ large.
Yeah, Your Honor.
It just seems like prudentially that might be the narrow, sensible way for us to deal with this.
We would be perfectly happy with a narrow win as opposed to a broad one. I'm not sure that the Supreme Court in the Hamani case is going to resolve a lot of questions that relate to 922 G1, but as you mentioned, perhaps their discussion of dangerousness in the 922 G3 context would shed some light on the other rationale, not the one that Medina primarily relied upon. Okay. I'm happy to answer any further questions if the court has them. If I can just briefly touch on some of the questions about the underlying facts of this case. The question about whether or not Mr. Richardson was on probation or supervision at the time of his offense, I think it's undisputed. In the undisputed facts in the PSR indicate that he was on supervision. His supervision term expired 10 days later. I think it was the PSR uses the term supervision and supervisory probation. I think because this was in Superior Court, it was not federal supervised release. It was Superior Court supervision. But it's clear that he was on some form of supervision. It's strange that it was that the PSR says that he successfully completed it, but that's not disputed that he was on supervision. And regarding the question of whether he was prohibited from possessing firearms while on probation, I pulled the Superior Court record, which I think this court could judicially notice if it chose to, and found that although he was not specifically prohibited from possessing a firearm, he was ordered to, quote, obey all laws, ordinances, and regulations. And so his possession of a firearm would violate federal law under 922 G1. It would violate DC code because he's once again for a third time carrying a pistol without a license. So should this court choose to rely on that sort of narrower ground to uphold the statute's application, I think there would be ample evidence in the record and judicially noticeable evidence to do so.
And what's your response to your friend on the other side's assertion that we can't consider things like supervised release, even if that's true?
Sure. Your Honor, the government's view is that the way to think about an as-applied challenge is that when you have a law that is facially valid and or presumptively lawful, as the Supreme Court has said, then it's really the defendant has to, and this is consistent with Medina too, the defendant has to do something to take himself out of the sort of mind run of applications where the law is constitutional and show that he's somehow different from those other people. He needs to show that he's different from Medina, who engaged in mortgage fraud. And this court concluded that that 25-year-old mortgage fraud conviction was enough to disarm him. And in order to do that, it seems like it's perfectly fair to consider not just the bare allegations in the indictment, which the allegation was simply that he was convicted of a crime punishable by for a term exceeding 1 year, and consider the defense wants you to consider the nature of those underlying charges, which is, I think, as you pointed out, an inconsistency in their view. But the government's view is that once you are trying to demonstrate that you don't fall within that sort of within the group of people to which a statute can be constitutionally applied, you have to show that based on your specific circumstances. And the government then can come back with additional specific circumstances to say, no, this is a perfectly constitutional application to this person.
Do you have any case law or authorities that support this view, which makes a lot of sense to me? But
so, Your Honor, we do have the decisions from the Third and the Fifth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit says that it's really totally an anything goes analysis in the Williams case. We've cited these in our brief, the Williams case from Sixth Circuit, Diaz from the Fifth Circuit, and the Moore case, which, again, maybe has had some doubt cast on it in the Third Circuit. So beyond that, I do think that if you read the Supreme Court decisions that the defense relies on, such as Patel, they're misunderstanding what those decisions said. So Patel dealt with a law that allowed the city to engage in warrantless searches, and the government of the city responded in defense of that law that, well, there you can think of at least some valid applications of this warrantless search statute because maybe there was consent. And the Supreme Court said, well, if there's consent, you don't even apply the warrantless search statute. So there's just no application. The law has no work to do. In this case, it's very different because here, Section 922 G1 clearly has work to do. It applies to someone who has been convicted of a crime punishable by a term exceeding 1 year. The question is just whether there are some additional facts beyond those elements that might show that it was constitutional or unconstitutional as applied to someone.
So Patel suggests that if a defendant came in and said, this is not constitutional as applied to me, the government can say, but you consented, and so therefore it is constitutional as applied to you.
No, Your Honor, but that's not what Patel said. Patel said that if in the context of a warrantless search statute, that the government can't defeat a facial challenge by hypothesizing non-applications of the statute. So if I were here saying, well, Section 922 G1 is constitutional.
Connect it to, sure, to the question before us, which is, can we consider things beyond what?
Yeah. Patel didn't resolve that one way or another, Your Honor.
Okay.
Patel is a facial challenge.
That's correct.
It's facial challenge law. It's about how to apply Salerno and what the relevant denominator is for the all possible applications.
That's correct.
Inquiry, I thought.
That's absolutely correct. And the reason that Patel doesn't support Mr. Richardson's argument here is that Patel, contrary to what to what Mr. Richardson argues, Patel doesn't say that that a statute like 922 G1 has no application. In this context, it clearly has the application in this context. What Patel simply said is you can't hypothesize non-applications of a statute in order to defeat a facial challenge. Here, in order to defeat the facial challenge Mr. Richardson's raises, we're not raising non-applications of a statute. For example, an application of this statute as applied to someone with a murder conviction, that's an application of the statute, and we're saying that's clearly constitutional. He can't win on a facial challenge. So that was my only point with respect to Patel.
Just for a second, back to your exchange with Judge Pan about how as applied challenges work. And you said that the defendant statute that is facially constitutional, no problem applying this statute to murder predicates. The defendant the challenger in an as-applied challenge has to do something to take himself out of the heartland of the statute. And that seems right to me in general, but is there any tension with the instruction in Bruin that the government
bears the burden of proving the relevant tradition with sufficient specificity. So, like, they do that writ large for felons, and that establishes facial constitutionality. And then you have an edge case with the conviction for opening the ketchup bottle or whatever, some weird right. felony.
Right.
You said it's the challenger has to do something to take him out of the heartland.
Sure.
Why isn't it the government's burden to show that the general tradition extends to the kind of conduct in the case?
Well, Your Honor, I'm sort of going beyond what the Supreme Court has clearly addressed, but here's how I would think about it. And these are admittedly complicated issues. The way I would think about it is the government's top line view that's consistent with Medina is that we have shown that Section 922 G1 is constitutional in all its applications. To the extent there are questionable, problematic cases, Congress dealt with that in 925C, which the department has recently revived. And so you don't need, there's
certain. 925C?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The Section 925C, we cite this in our brief, is a statute that Congress passed that says that someone can regain their right to possess firearms if they can show they're not a danger to the community. So that's
petitioning the Attorney General, wasn't it?
That's correct. Yeah. Petitioning the Attorney General. So that's our sort of top line view.
Okay.
But let's assume we're
suppose
wrong.
Suppose I think you've proven constitutionality for the Heartland application, but I'm worried about these edge cases.
Exactly. In that situation, Your Honor, I think the best way to think about it would be to say that the defendant needs to come forward with something to show that he falls outside the heartland. It would be very odd if the government had the burden of digging up every possible fact about, you know, the age of the defendant's criminal history or his rehabilitation, that sort of thing. Again, I could be wrong on that. And if the government does bear the burden even there, I think we could satisfy it in Mr. Richardson's case. But I think the defendant would need to come forward, say, at least make an allegation and a motion to dismiss an indictment saying, you know, this can't be constitutionally applied to me because of X. And then I think the government would have the burden of showing
it's a burden of production or articulation. And then you have you show that the tradition applies with sufficient clarity.
That's correct, Your Honor. So I think probably the best way to understand the Supreme Court's decision in Bruin is that the government bears the burden of persuasion on the constitutional question at the first level. General, you know, in sort of the general applications. And then when facing an as-applied challenge, can respond to the defendant's challenge. And our view is that when we're responding to that challenge, we can point to things outside of the bare elements of the offense, because that's exactly what the defense is doing in that situation.
That makes sense. Okay. Judge Pan, anything else? Judge Ginsburg?
Thank you. We'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Ms. Millian, we'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. Really quick to start, I actually have the case number for the Third Circuit case where they granted en banc. So in Boost, it is 24-17-19. And that cites the civil case where they granted en banc review as well in that en banc order. And that'll have the case number for that case for you.
I'm sorry. One is 24-17-19.
And I don't have the case number for the other one, but if you
read the pointer, it will find it in Boost.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, got it.
So I just, Your Honor asked some questions about whether the burden makes a difference in the Medina decision. And I just want to quickly dwell on that for a minute, because I think it makes a huge difference in why the court came out the way it did. It specifically noted that there were few primary sources directly on point. It noted the absence of founding era regulations disarming individuals for past convictions. And it used language like on balance to describe the way it was coming out in that case, indicating that it found the issue to be in relative equipoise. And so the fact that it seemed to understand the burden to rest with the plaintiff is what drove its decision. That was the main point I wanted to make, but I welcome any additional questions you all have.
Japan, anything?
I just
I know it's not entirely clear in Medina, but it, I just remember seeing that it, them noting that it was the government's burden, at least to the extent of proving that the defendant was dangerous. I just don't think it was very clear that they were assigning the burden to the defendant.
Let me, if you don't mind, let me grab a copy of it.
Okay.
So I'm not sure what you're referring to, Your Honor, but I mean, the points that I mentioned before, I think, demonstrate the importance of the burden. It specifically notes that none of the sources cited by Medina compels the conclusion that only dangerous people can be disarmed, which, of course, was the context of his as-applied challenge. He'd argued that only dangerous felons could be disarmed. And it says things like, to the extent it may be possible for a felon to show that his crime was so minor or regulatory that he did not forfeit his right to arms by committing it, Medina has not done so. Again, that's evidence that the court is placing the burden on Medina to prove that this a particular historical tradition permits him to carry his firearm rather than the reverse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Judge Ginsburg? Okay. Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel for really exceptionally good briefing and advocacy. We appreciate it. The case is submitted.